The death this week of the wonderful singer Dr. Giyuna Pingu, at the age of just 46 from long-term illness, brings home once again the disparity in life expectancy between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians. On average, it's 10 years. Why? Why is this? Why does it still seem so hard to close this gap? John Patterson is the Chief Executive Officer of the Aboriginal Medical Services Alliance of the Northern Territory. John is a Nalakan man from southeast Arnhem Land. Now, John, in remote areas of Australia, the rates of end-stage kidney disease for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islanders are, well, they're up to 20 times higher than those for non-Indigenous Australians. Why are those rates so much higher?
Good morning, Amanda. And look, my early response to that is because of the lack of a range and multiple services and programs to those living in remote rural Australia. We see that the services, particularly health services and other services that are critical to enable Aboriginal people living and working in remote communities struggle to enjoy the lifestyle options and choices that other Australians enjoy in the regional and capital cities, for example. Look, we've had the life expectancy, you're right, is 10 years. It has improved in the late 1990s, early 2000, and the reason behind that was because we had a reasonable injection of funding from the Commonwealth Government, which was packaged up as part of the Australian Government intervention that was in the Northern Territory at that time. And we were able to provide those resources to priority areas, which our clinicians and our medical services saw as a priority, and we were able to specifically target those areas with the appropriate resources and funding that we got from the Commonwealth Government. That's plateaued out in recent times.
Yes, and what you're saying, I guess, is it can be changed. Let's just hang on to that. We'll get back to that. But also sure. With us is Dr. Jill Gorman. She's the manager of the Renal Research Program at the Menzies School of Health Research in Darwin, and she was nurse manager for 15 years at the Royal Darwin Hospital. Jill, we know kidney disease is very debilitating, and in the latter stages, you can need dialysis up to 3 times a week. Huge disruption to your life. And, you know, if you're living a long way from a hospital, it throws an even bigger spanner in the works. From your experience, what happens to someone living remotely when they have kidney disease?
Good morning, Amanda. Just clarify, I'm not a doctor.
Beg your pardon. We'll take the doctor title off you.
Yes, thank you. It's quite difficult for people when they realise that they have got kidney disease, and so the primary health services manages that in consultation with the tertiary services, so a nephrologist based usually in the urban area. And there is a staging process, so people have different types of treatments or care along the way. But at some stage, when they realise that they must start dialysis, then they will be referred to the surgeons, and some access will be created, whether that's a fistula in their arm or whether they choose to have peritoneal dialysis. And this chooses their form of treatment as well in the long term, whether they go on to hemodialysis or peritoneal dialysis. And then they may have to make the decision about whether they relocate to the urban area to have treatment.
And that's where it becomes difficult, I think, for people to be moving.
It is a very difficult situation because most services are centralised. So when they move to the urban area, they then have to find appropriate accommodation, whether it be a hostel or a house. If they choose a house, it means that they can have their family with them, and that's often more comfortable. But houses usually don't come furnished, and then they don't have the finances to buy the fridge, the bed, the equipment they need. And that then leads into other things such as, you know, do I have a fridge? Can I buy food that lasts me for a week, or do I eat takeaway? There's difficulties with understanding the transport system in the urban area, how to catch a bus, whether I take a taxi, which is more expensive. Going to treatment 3 times a week, the services do provide some transport depending on where they live. But any other movement around town is dependent on them understanding how they can do that. And things like, you know, when they're in their own community, they can go bush tucker hunting and share their resources. That's not as convenient to do in the urban area. They don't know where to go to find the food. They don't have the transport or the boat or the car to get there. And, of course, there's other costs associated with that.
Well, John, the Aboriginal Medical Services Alliance that you head up runs 50% of the primary healthcare services for Indigenous people in the Northern Territory. So your workers are at the coalface of so many health issues. Now, people close to Dr. G. Yunupingu, including his physician, have spoken about his reluctance, refusal actually, to have renal treatment in the last weeks of his life. More generally, is there a cultural reluctance to have this treatment?
I think so, and given, you know, the points that Jill just highlighted as well puts enormous strain on families that have one of their own that's required to uplift from their home communities and have to relocate into places like, you know, Darwin and Alice Springs, Catherine, where those renal, you know, the more acute renal care and services are present to get that treatment. And that puts enormous strain on that individual. And, you know, I experienced with my own family. I had a brother, an uncle and a cousin, all had amputated parts of their bodies due to diabetes and renal disease. And in the end, that, you know, I mean, they were in a similar boat. And, you know, my brother particularly, he was taken back to Royal Darwin Hospital, and the doctor said that he had to get his other leg chopped off. And he just reluctantly said, no, I'm not going to go through that pain. I'd rather go back to the nursing home and live my remaining days out there, you know, the way I enjoy life. And if it means shortening my lifespan, then so be it. You know, there's a lot of stress, a lot of strain, a lot of trauma put on individuals and their families to unfortunately get these services, which are predominantly, as Jill says, centralised either in the main centres and regional centres throughout the Northern Territory. We've been advocating as the PCOT, you know, Community Controlled Health Service, to get some of those chairs, renal chairs, and some of the basic renal service treatments back as close to communities as possible. Now, I note there was a chair in Galawinku, Mr. Yunupingu's home community there, but I noted, and one of our member services was actually providing the renal service there, but due to the lack of funding to fund a nurse that to be there on almost a 24/7, you know, you need more than one nurse in these situations. You just can't have that whole responsibility of renal dialysis treatment just put on one clinician. You need a number of them because they, you know, there are a number of people that probably reside in Galawinku that require renal dialysis, and you need the capacity and the workforce to be able to cope with that. And unfortunately, that wasn't there due to lack of funding, like I say. And our member service, the Western Desert Dialysis, is doing a tremendous job under the limited resources. And we need the support of governments at all levels to really get behind and seriously commit some longer-term funding to these sorts of services that are impacting hugely on Aboriginal families and individuals.
Well, Jill, you've been a key person in making home dialysis an option for Indigenous Australians in the Northern Territory. I think you helped establish the first remote staff dialysis unit in Australia staffed by Indigenous workers. What sort of impact has this had so far in tackling some of the issues John's been talking about, and what are the problems still with that?
So currently there's probably about 30 communities that have services or infrastructure that would enable people to be at home, but not all of them are staffed, as John's pointed out. And staffing remote dialysis units has a number of issues, such as retention and recruitment. There are also issues with it requires a lot of administration support, because getting the equipment out there and the consumables that are used for the dialysis treatment is quite time consuming. You have to use three or four different transport modes. So, a truck to get the equipment to the barge, and then a barge out to the community, whether it be the coastal communities or Tiwi Islands.
Yeah, the challenges are big, aren't they?
It's huge, and it takes a lot of time. And John's quite right. We don't have enough resources dedicated to that sort of treatment model. But there are a number of people that are doing their own treatment out in the communities, and there's probably about 35 people in the top end that actually are doing self-care treatment. But there's also a group of people that will never be able to do their own dialysis, and they're the ones that require the support of a staff facility. And there has to be some sort of hybrid model that allows both of those models of care to happen.
Well, now, taking a look at the hospital system, the city hospital system, last year it was suggested by his management that Dr. Unapingu wasn't being properly treated in hospital in Darwin because of racial profiling. That was the accusation. From both your perspectives and experiences, I wonder if you've seen this. John?
Look, I can't say that I've seen any evidence about those allegations, but what we are encouraging the acute care of the hospital system, and particularly in hospitals and other health clinics, that we have, and it'd be almost compulsory for new employees and current employees to get regular cross-cultural training, cultural security training, both at the Royal Darwin Hospital level. And also, if they're relocating into remote community clinics, that they also undertake a second cross-cultural training and course with the local Aboriginal communities at those local regional levels. So, it requires community awareness, community education. We do have teams that are prepared, and I know that the Territory Health Department turned its focus on this some years ago. Whether it's still being offered I'm not sure, but it's certainly something that I'll be raising with the chief executive when we next meet, and just to make sure that course and that program is being offered to new clinicians that particularly and predominantly most of them come from South, straight out of medical school. And they need to be aware of the cultural sensitivities, the cultural requirements and all those sensitive issues, just to be made aware of it so that if they're faced with those sorts of situations, they know, well, hopefully they'll make the right decision about how to approach it.
Jill, have you ever been aware of anything approaching racial profiling?
No, I can't say that I have. I do witness miscommunication and cultural misunderstanding, and as John said, often it's cultural insensitivity, but I can't say that I've seen racial profiling.
You're listening to Life Matters with Amanda Smith, and with the death this week of the Indigenous singer Dr. G. Unapingu at the age of just 46, we're grappling with why there is still such a discrepancy in life expectancy between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people in Australia, with Jill Gorham, who's the manager of the Renal Research Program at the Menzies School of Health Research in Darwin, and John Patterson, the Chief Executive Officer of the Aboriginal Medical Services Alliance of the Northern Territory. John, in the big picture sense, can you summarise for us why in Australia Indigenous people do die on average 10 years younger than non-Indigenous people?
Well, as your previous speaker, I think John Lawrence said on the earlier program, have we got a couple of hours for this? Because, look, generally and in a nutshell, this requires a multi-pronged approach. It requires the political willpower and commitment from politicians federally and at the state territory levels about committing long-term funding arrangements across a number of issues and portfolio areas, and that includes housing, education, law and justice, health, you name it. I mean, it's right across the board. We need a commitment from, like I say, from governments to provide the appropriate resources, because what I've observed over the three decades that I've been working in Aboriginal affairs, particularly in the Northern Territory, is that there's been these silo-type funding packages that come out, particularly from the federal government. You know, one year it might be for housing, and you might get 20 to 50 houses being built out of that, you know, whatever that funding package is allocated for. The next budget might be some funding package around education and so on. What we really need is a packaged across all those portfolio areas to be given, you know, over a period of no more than, you know, siloed over 5 years. It needs to come preferably packaged all together so that we're tackling all these issues at the one time. Health can't reduce all those, the life expectancy on its own. We require people to have decent housing, food security, you know, good quality foods in some of those, well, a lot of those remote communities. Education, you know, we now have the evidence that if we can get to those 0 to 5 years, get preschool, get mums and dads reading books to their to their little ones, and getting at least 2 to 3 years earlier preschool, there's evidence to say that those kiddies, when they grow up and you know, enter primary school and secondary and hopefully tertiary schooling, have a better chance of making decisions around their lifestyle and the choices that they make. It's great to see, I note another COAG, you know, goals, there's six of them, I think, that we are making some slight increases in year 12 graduations.
Yes, that's
fine.
That's the one area.
Well, yeah.
Jill, friends close to Dr. Unipingu have said that they were somewhat confronted about the way he was living prior to his death. From what you've seen of Indigenous Australia, how pervasive is this matter of Aboriginal people not receiving or indeed refusing the medical treatment they need, particularly in late-term illnesses?
I think it's very difficult for people to reconcile their treatment requirements with their previous way of living. And certainly when people have to relocate to the urban area, it's a bit of a culture shock. They're on somebody else's land. They're foreign. They don't have standing in the community, whereas they would have had standing in their own community. They're away from their community support network. They're away from their family. It's quite devastating. I can't see, you know, if it happened to me and I had to go to Adelaide for treatment and leave my family behind, I don't know how I would manage. And we expect them to manage, excuse me.
Yeah.
Plus we expect them to find their own accommodation, or they get assistance with that. But being able to live with your family in suitable accommodation is very different from living in a hostel where you can only have your partner and you can't have as many visitors as you'd like. So, yes, there's quite a number of people that find that quite difficult and don't reconcile and choose to go home and not have any further treatment. And then there are people who want to live on, and so they have this to-ing and fro-ing, going back and forth between the community and the urban area, missing treatments, not wanting to give up dialysis, not wanting to die, but not being able to, as I said, reconcile the two.
John, what do you think Australia can learn from the early death of Dr. Unipingu?
That we've got a long way to go, I think, and it requires the efforts of everybody, and particularly governments. I can't emphasise that governments need to really seriously have the political willpower and willingness to listen to the Aboriginal leadership across this country, particularly in focusing here on health. You know, we've provided primary healthcare services now in the Northern Territory for 40 years plus, so we do have the track record. We've got a good database of statistics now that we can measure and follow trends and, you know, regularly have a look at how we're performing against some of those key performance indicators. We've got great continuous quality improvement programs in place that, you know, we're regularly reviewing the way we go about our business, but we're hamstrung. At the end of the day, we're hamstrung because of the lack of resources, which impacts on workforce, which impacts on housing, which impacts on families being able to put food on the table for their families. Unemployment, you know, in the Northern Territory, in remote communities, more than 40% of adults are unemployed. How can you expect, you know, the adults of those families providing the appropriate meals, you know, consistently on the tables for those little kiddies at night?
As you say, you know, yeah, it's a long way to go.
It's a long way.
John Paterson is the Chief Executive Officer of the Aboriginal Medical Services Alliance of the Northern Territory. John is a Nalakan man from southeast Arnhem Land. And Jill Gorham is the manager of the Renal Research Program at the Menzies School of Health Research in Darwin. Jill was also nurse manager for 15 years at the Royal Darwin Hospital. Jill and John, thank you both so much for joining us here in Life Matters.
Thanks, Amanda.
It's Amanda Smith with you. This is Life Matters.